Welcome to Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU, where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, pull it apart, and put the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staber. This season, we're untangling the housing crisis, and we centered our first three episodes on why home prices keep going up. But the journey to home ownership begins long before you're ready to buy. Student loans, childcare, gas, groceries, all these costs impact whether there's anything left to squirrel away for that down payment. We're spending the next hour untangling how your budget blocks you from buying. This is episode 4, The Price of Everything. If you were born in the 80s, 90s, even the early 2000s, you probably heard this story from your parents. Go to college, get good grades, work hard, and earn a ticket to the good life.
Yeah, I mean, not just my parents. That was the message that was parroted to me from every angle, even starting back in kindergarten. You know, kindergarten teachers are saying, oh, you guys gotta start working hard now.
That's Chris Corcoran. He's a student at Ohio State University, an intern for All Sides, and the producer of Untangled.
I was in elementary school when No Child Left Behind was instituted, and that was one of the things where they were trying to bump up the college enrollment. You know, higher access to higher education was a big thing, and so that was drilled into us. It's, you know, if you do good in school, you go to college, you get a good job, and you're financially stable. And now it's kind of not really coming to fruition.
Is that frustrating? It's frustrating for me.
I mean, it is frustrating to an extent, but it's also just, I mean, I recognize they didn't know. They didn't know any better than we did.
Yeah, because it worked for them.
Yeah, it did work for them. It's just a completely different, you know, economic situation now.
Chris is right. It is a totally different economic situation now because paying for your college tuition with a part-time or even a full-time minimum wage job just isn't possible anymore.
This idea of being able to go, you know, economic independence, live on your own. That's at the heart of, you know, the American, that is the American dream. And it's changing, if not completely disappearing before our eyes.
Chris and his friends try not to think about what's going to happen when they graduate and their student loan payments kick in. And they're not wrong. After mortgage debt, Americans have more student loan debt than credit cards or any other category. But it didn't used to be this way. In the early 1980s, students could pay their way through college at Ohio's public universities by working 10 hours a week during the school year and full-time during the summer. Here to help us untangle why that doesn't work anymore is Ohio State professor Stephanie Moulton. She's also the Associate Dean for Faculty Research with the Glenn College of Public Policy. So, Stephanie, you study consumer debt. And college loans are the second largest kind of consumer debt. How do you think that factors into our ability to save for a home loan?
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me, Anna. This is such an important topic. Yeah, student loan debt has risen, as you've noted, markedly over the last couple of decades. 25% of adults age 25 had student loan debt in 2004. That's up to 45% in 2016, and it just keeps rising. And so student loan debt is important, as you noted at the start of the show, in order to enable people to be able to pursue higher education. But it does affect the ability to save for that first-time home in a couple of different ways. So, you know, it does, you know, slow your ability to save for the down payment. It also affects your ability to qualify for a mortgage. So in order to qualify for a mortgage, they're going to look at your monthly debt payments. And student loan debt becomes one of the largest portions of your debt payment. And I think in some of your other episodes, you've talked about the rising housing costs that we're facing too. Home prices are going up and Ohio is no exception. And so as you're, you know, if you think about the amount of your money that you have each month to pay for your mortgage payment, that mortgage payment's getting bigger and your student loan debt is getting larger, and that's going to increase that payment. And it's going to harm your ability to be able to qualify for a mortgage. So both being able to save for the down payment, but then also being able to just qualify for a mortgage based on the amount of income that you have for your housing payment.
I suspect this might be the reason we're seeing a decline in people going to college. And I try to be careful about throwing out too many numbers on a radio show. But there was this analysis combining census data, National Center for Education Statistics, and the Bureau of Labor. And they found that since 1980, college costs are up nearly 170%, while earnings for recent graduates have only increased by 19%. So basically, we're paying more and earning less.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. One of my good colleagues, Mita Brown, here at OSU, she's an economist. She's done some really interesting research on this, looking at the rising costs of student loan debt or just rising costs of higher education. And does that translate into people just not going to school, or does it cause them to take on more debt? And she actually finds that, you know, maybe there is a slight decline in higher ed, but she sees that people are actually just taking on more debt and still pursuing that education. Which gets to your point that, you know, if earnings are not increasing at the same rate, post-graduation earnings, then these costs are increasing without kind of the commensurate increase in earnings we would hope to get from that investment.
I want to bring Chris back into the conversation. He's the student from Ohio State who's been helping me produce this series. And he made this really interesting point about the job market his parents graduated into versus the one he expects when he graduates next year.
But also another thing that I don't think addressed as much is just the saturation of college graduates nowadays. When my parents went to college, it was 19 to 20% of people were getting degrees. There were not as many people competing for these jobs. So
it's
now,
not worth as much anymore.
Exactly. So now as people are coming out of college, the bar is getting higher and higher to even get an entry-level job. So, you know, work experience, which is necessary to get those better jobs down the line, is harder to come by.
What do you make of that, that as more people get degrees, it doesn't become as special as it was, say, 20, 30, even 50 years ago?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. You know, I think that the return on investment for a college of education is really important to think about when one's pursuing a degree. And I know we often don't think in those terms. You don't want to pursue a degree strictly because of the income potential you might get from it. You know, we want people to go into arts and humanities. They may not pay the same as going into medicine or law, for example, but we still want people to pursue those degrees. You know, I think that there's been a couple of things that are trying to be done to address this issue. One is thinking about right-sizing student loan debt to an individual's income. So, you know, the income-driven repayment plans that have been talked about that do exist, I think about a third of students with student loan debt today are on income-driven repayment plans. The idea is to kind of right-size that student loan debt payment, at least, and maybe even the amount that you have, to the income earning potential that you have. So if your income is lower, your monthly repayment would be lower. And until we do something like that more systematically, I think it is increasingly challenging if you graduate with $80,000, $50,000, $20,000 in student loan debt, and you're not earning the same as you know, to be able to repay that debt, then it creates a significant burden.
So, you know, you're at Ohio State University, which is a public college. What role do you think the state has to play in all of this? Because if you look at in terms of real dollars, how much the state has been investing in higher education, it took a real hit in the recession, and it just doesn't seem like it's fully recovered.
Yeah, I mean, I think my expertise is primarily related to how debt affects the ability to purchase a home. So speaking in that regard, what role can the state play in helping alleviate some of these burdens? I think, you know, there are various ways we can think about that. One is to provide subsidies to help individuals either pay back their student loan debt or to forgive some of the student loan debt, or to kind of soften the size of that the debt payment so that somebody would be able to afford that mortgage. I think there's also education policies we have to think about, but I don't focus on education policy in my research, so I'm not as versed in that area. But on the debt side, I absolutely think there are things that we can do and that the state can do and is trying to do to try to address some of this. But for sure, I think it's a challenge that we need to be thinking about.
And it's not just college loan debt, credit card debt, car right. debt, basically any debt that you're carrying factors into whether you can afford a house.
Absolutely. And those costs have all been increasing. As you've noted, the cost of everything, right, is going up. And so we've got this kind of perfect storm of house prices going up. It's a strong economy in some ways, which is good, but it's also causing this increase in house prices, increases in interest rates, as we've seen over time, and then also increases in the monthly cost that people are paying. And that makes it really difficult for a new prospective individual to enter homeownership today.
Particularly if people get into desperate situations and find themselves taking out payday loans.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, those are some of the most costly forms of debt, right? So there's often a spectrum of debt that people can enter, and not all debt is bad. I often say, sometimes we use debt to get ahead, but payday loans are often a kind of debt that we turn to when we don't have any other alternative, and they can be very high cost and definitely can create hardship for individuals.
One of the things that I find bothers people when they go to get approved for a home loan is that you can qualify for a rent that's much higher than what the bank will let you pay for your monthly mortgage. And I get it. I can feel the frustration there, right? Like if I can swing $3,000 a month, why can't I swing it in a mortgage?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. In the olden days, the traditional rule of thumb was 36%. So you couldn't spend more than a bank wouldn't approve you underwriting for more than 36% of your monthly income for your mortgage payment plus all of your other finance debt. And that includes car payments, student loan payments, credit card payments, any other finance bills. It was capped at 36%. That rose during the great, the big housing boom and bust cycle that we had in 2008 when underwriting relaxed. A lot of those debt to income thresholds really relaxed as well. They have tightened a lot again, to your point, and it's not clear that they've, sometimes we do worry that they've tightened too much, that we've actually kind of over squished the bug, so to speak. Worried about people not getting into situations where they can't afford their monthly mortgage payment by taking on too much debt. We try to, underwriters try to set that guideline, but it is true that a lot of individuals that maybe could afford that mortgage are maybe not able to get approved because of the debt to income thresholds. And I think that is a role for policy. It's a role for, it's an interesting alternative underwriting that's being explored. Can we use different ways of thinking about how we underwrite mortgages so that we can find individuals that could afford to make these payments? And as you note, if they're making that payment for rent, then and they've been making that payment for rent on time for 12 months, then they're probably a good credit risk.
And I also want to touch on credit scores because this really impacts the interest rate that you get for everything. And one of the things I think people don't realize necessarily that it's not just do I pay my bills on time, but how much available credit I
Yes.
have. And so I'm hoping you can kind of explain that for folks.
Yeah, that's a huge thing, and you're absolutely right that people don't think about that. So it is about your available credit as well. So the credit score is comprised of several different components. One of those components is your payment history, as you noted. So have you been delinquent on debt? Have you been paying your debt on time? But another component of it is your credit availability. And so that's going to look at, so if you have credit cards, for example, and you have a $10,000 max credit line on your credit card, and your balance is at $8,000, that's actually going to negatively affect your credit score. So they like you to keep your balances below 50 and actually even below 30 to be optimal of the credit limit, which is not the way no we normally think. So why do I need a $10,000 credit line on my credit card? I'm never going to spend that much. Well, it's because it actually does, it may help kind of keep that liquidity or that available credit amount to be higher so that it can make your credit score higher. But you're exactly right. If and think about a mortgage as well. If you're at you take out a mortgage for the majority of your home's value, that's going to make you at a very high balance to credit ratio, we would say, and that could negatively impact your credit score too.
So next week, Untangled is drilling down on the wealth gap. But I did want to ask you, since you study reverse mortgages, how that impacts families and the transfer of wealth from one generation to another.
Oh, well, that's an excellent question. I don't know if our listeners out there know about what reverse mortgages are, but this is something that I've spent quite a bit of time researching with my colleagues and I. Reverse mortgages allow older adults and usually age 62 and older, to be able to extract equity from their home with no monthly payment. And so to the point that you're getting at here about these cash flow burdens that people have, we know older adults in particular experience those cash flow burdens. A lot of older adults have no other source of income other than Social Security, but many older adults own their home. 80% of older adults own their home. And so they may have equity in their home, but have very limited income. And so the reverse mortgage was originally conceived of as this idea to provide individuals, older adults, an ability to have access to liquidity from their home. They could get some of that money out of their home without having to sell their home. So typically an older adult would have to sell their home in order to get that equity out. but then they have to pay for rent somewhere. And many older adults want to live in their homes. And so reverse mortgage became a tool for that. I do think that that's a really good question, though. One thing that we've scratched our heads about, it's this balance between is the reverse mortgage, is it the right time for an individual in their life cycle to take out the reverse mortgage to make ends to help make ends meet or to be part of a financial planning package for them? Or how is this going to affect kind of the long-term kind of wealth generation and ability to pass wealth on from one generation to the next? And that's a great question. I mean, if all older adults took out reverse mortgages, and they spent all of that equity from their reverse mortgage, there may be nothing left to pass on to heirs. And so that could reduce intergenerational transfers of wealth. On the other hand, a lot of older adults, based on Medicaid recapture programs, things like that, a lot of that equity might end up getting spent down in the end of life anyways. And so it's a trade-off. There's all sorts of complex formulas we have to think about. And so it's really, there's not a one size fits all. It's always bad or it's always good. I think it's something that has risks. And so really thinking about those things is really important.
Yeah, you make a really good point with Medicaid because I am continually surprised by the percentage of older adults who use Medicaid, not Medicare, but Medicaid for long-term care.
And
And they
it's
have
good that it's available,
very
but it
strict asset ratios. Like you will
absolutely.
sell your house before Medicaid will pick you up.
Absolutely. So that's, I mean, I think that's where, we think about we want to save this home for our heirs, but it may or may not be going to our heirs. And so really kind of planning out in your kind of end of life plan how what that's going to look like, I think is important. And a reverse mortgage could be part of that plan, but it isn't for everybody and it can be very costly. And so it's got to be something that is thought about carefully and discussed with your family.
That was Stephanie Moulton, an Ohio State professor and the Associate Dean for Faculty and Research with the Glenn College of Public Policy. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me, Anna.
Coming up, we're untangling how childcare, groceries, and gas factor into whether you can buy a house. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a new series from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Anna Staver. The price of everything at the grocery store keeps going up, and not in the normal inflationary kind of way. Food prices are up 25% since 2019. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And though the inflation has slowed, we are still feeling the effects. Then you add childcare. Costs keep going up as the number of providers keep going down. In Ohio, the average cost to put a toddler in daycare is about $11,000. So between school loans, groceries, car insurance, and childcare, it can feel impossible to save for a house. Joining us to untangle why it all feels so much harder right now, more expensive than it was just a few years ago, is Ken Johnson. He's the Associate Dean of Graduate Programs in Finance and a Professor of Finance at Florida Atlantic University. Welcome to Untangled.
Good morning, Anna. Glad to be here.
I want to bring Chris back into this conversation. He's the college student here at Ohio State who's been helping me produce this series. He says him and his friends try not to think about what life is going to be like when they graduate next year.
It's concerning. To look into the future and not be sure. I mean, you're never sure, but to not feel like there's kind of a reliable pathway to home ownership and to kind of stability. So it's more just kind of it's frightening.
An uneasiness?
Yeah, exactly. There's just so much that I'm looking forward at that even beyond the normal, normal concern over, you know, unsure about what the future holds. Now there's this added layer of, even after graduating college, will I be able to have that financial stability? Will I be able to, you know, kind of support myself?
I think a lot of us have that feeling, this sense of struggling since the pandemic, that even though unemployment is down, the stock market is up, and the feds say salaries are outpacing inflation, it's how can we have all these good economic indicators without people feeling the effects of them?
Well, and a lot of this is probably perception. I did a little background and tried to do a centering on the Columbus housing market in particular. And we were most interested in what does it cost to rent in the Columbus area? What does it cost to own in the Columbus area? How far out of whack, if at all, are these things? And what's true right now in Columbus is that both renting, right, and owning is higher than normal. Now, that's come from the inflation that we've been facing the last few years. So, yes, everybody's feeling that pinch. But when you try to compare that relatively, which one should you do, rent or own? And I mean rent and reinvest monies that would otherwise be put into to home ownership. Then you find that, especially on the rent side, you're not really that far out of whack. Renting in on a local and national level, renting in Columbus, if you look at the top 100 metros in the U.S. market, meaning by size only, you're looking at a placement of 77th out of 100 in terms of being overpriced. So it's priced very well. On the housing side, the premium's up around 30+%, and you're the 22nd most overpriced housing market. So right now, renting and reinvesting in the Columbus area is probably a really good idea.
Yeah, especially if you're still struggling to make that down payment, because as home prices go up, you know, that 3%, 5%, 10%, whatever you're going to put down also goes up. And I think one of the biggest things that gets in the way outside of school debt, which we talked about earlier, is childcare debt or childcare payments, rather. And anyone who's had a kid knows that it can be more than your mortgage. You can be spending $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 if you have multiple kids just to keep them in all day care. And do you see that going away anytime soon? Or do you just think like this is what we pay for the cost of childcare now?
A little of both. This will normalize through time. Childcare is a little bit out of my area of expertise, but home prices, that's what's out of whack in the Columbus area. The good news on the Columbus side, by the way, is that your expected population growth in the next 10 years is up around 10%, which is probably in the top 20%. This is in terms of population. Probably in the top 20% of markets in the country. So you hear so much about people leaving the Midwest and moving to Florida or to the Sun Belt states. That's not necessarily going on in Columbus, Ohio. So in the long run, I'm very optimistic. When I sat down to do my research, I was expecting to see some numbers to be a little bit more gloomy, but in fact, they're not. But yes, other items are being impacted by inflation, and that's childcare. It's a very labor-intense industry. And as the cost of everything goes up, the cost of that labor will have to rise to compensate for just the rising costs that they face as staffers and owners in that business.
Yeah, I've been, the more I get into this series, the more I've been thinking about the growth here in Central Ohio as growing pains, because the housing creation, the building market, is just not keeping pace with the pace of people moving in. And you might argue as a city, that's a good problem to have. To have so many people coming in that you can't build houses fast enough. But the downside of that is the houses you do have get a lot more expensive.
They do. Real estate is what's called priced inelastic, meaning that's wonky, but an easier way to say this is you can't build them fast enough to capture the incoming population at times. So what you see in the meantime is an increase in the average density, the average number of people living in a unit will rise. Over time, that will flatten out. But I feel certain without being on the ground, this is exactly what is going on in the Columbus metro area at this point in time. Unlike many parts of the Midwest and the Northeast, you are actually growing in population. So the building, I would be surprised, I would not be surprised to know that the pace of building of both multifamily apartments and single family residences to own are not keeping pace with the demand. So therefore we're seeing this rise in price.
Yeah. And I think when you couple like the rising price, the rising interest rates, too, because one of the things we were talking about earlier on in the season is that you know, to qualify for the median home here in Central Ohio, it's gone from earning $70,000 for a family to earning $110,000 for a family. And that's just the interest rate. It had nothing to do with the price of the home rising. And so that income qualification, that monthly payment, when you add in, say, $3,000 a month for childcare and $500 in cars and $500 in student loans, like, it just, like, that $120,000 is assuming that you're not carrying all that other debt on top of that.
That is absolutely correct. So for right now, in terms of ownership, I did some back of the envelope calculations, and just on principal and interest alone, to buy the average home in the Columbus area, looking at the average income, you're going to be spending 30% of your gross and monthly. You can make it on an annual or monthly basis. You're going to spend 30% of your gross monthly take home. Then you have to add on taxes and insurance to that, as well as all these other items for rising childcare costs, rising food costs. It's getting very expensive. And again, I would encourage people in the area to think about renting and reinvesting those monies that you would otherwise put into home ownership. Myself and a couple other academics, we do research in this area, and we find that renting and reinvesting into a portfolio of stocks and bonds outperforms, though only slightly on average, home ownership and building equity. So what it allows you to do is do one of those two things. Don't rent and spend the difference on consumption. So yes, one way to fight inflation right now in that area perhaps might be that renting and reinvesting. If you don't feel comfortable making that reinvestment every month, then perhaps you should look to home ownership at this point in time.
And I will make a quick pitch that All Sides last week dedicated an hour to inflation, everything you never wanted to know about it, sort of an inflation 101. But that's the thing, right? It is dropping. It has dropped beyond the peak that it was in 2021, 2022, where we saw, you know, 8, 9, 10% inflation in certain categories. So it's, but I think when you tell people that the price of, say, eggs is rising less than it was 2 years ago, that's not exactly a warm and fuzzy feeling that it conjures.
That's exactly correct. Where is this good feeling that we should have because inflation is slowly getting back in line? And the answer is we had a couple of years there of very high inflation, which means as our incomes, yes, our incomes are rising pretty rapidly now, but they have not risen as much as inflation. So as a percentage of everything we buy relative to our income, it's more expensive today than it was pre-COVID. There's no doubt about that. But the silver lining in the cloud for Columbus, I think, is this expected population growth, the fact that a major U.S. university is right there. U.S. College towns are prospering. Columbus is amongst them. I just think that's kind of a hidden gem that you have. But that doesn't get us anywhere right now. It's what are we having to pay right now? And until we see that turnaround, until we see prices do flatten out enough on across the board, not only housing, but food, energy, et cetera, until our incomes are once again impacted the same level that they were pre-COVID, I don't think you're going to find very many comfortable households.
Yeah, I think that that gets to the heart of what Chris said earlier, is that you're looking ahead to the cost of everything. And even, you know, you think of kids graduating college, they should be excited, right? They're going off into the world, they're becoming adults, and so many of them have such trepidation about what kind of world they're going into right now.
Well, you're talking to someone that might be a little jaded. Without giving my age, I can tell you when I came out of school, unemployment was double digit. Interest rates on homes were double digit. And yet, we never make enough to own our own homes. That wasn't true. In the end, many people of my generation have prospered and done well, and we will do so again. But it's difficult. It's difficult. I left college at a really bad economic time, and I'm not proud of it. But I will admit that I attended bar and drove a forklift. I perhaps am the most educated forklift driver that anyone will ever meet. But I did that for a couple of years as the economy recovered, and I had to forego that home ownership. And yes, I continued to live like I was in college with three of my best friends. which looking back, I would trade that today. That was a really fun time in my life. But it is, you're nervous when you're leaving school or when you're young, and those opportunities don't appear to be there that were there for your parents or grandparents, but they are there, or they will be there. I would encourage you to save at every level. That is just, it's something that's hard to explain. You hear a lot of financial arguments that basically all center back to leverage, which makes me nervous. But I'll quote my mother when she used to tell me, you can't go broke if you don't owe money. So always be saving. That is something, even if it's just a little early in your life, it will truly magnify at the end of your career.
That was Ken Johnson, an associate dean of graduate programs in finance and a professor of finance at Florida Atlantic University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Coming up, we're talking commissions, predatory lenders, and more with the former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a series from All Sides and WOSU. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling the housing crisis this season, and we're deep diving into the cost of everything except housing this hour, from your groceries to your gas to college loans and childcare, how your budget blocks you from buying a house. And here to explain the impact of inflationary costs and interest rates and predatory lending in all things consumer financial is Richard Cordray, the former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Welcome to Untangled.
Thank you, Anna. Sounds like I'm getting just all the simple subjects.
Inflation, interest rates, yeah. National Association of Realtors, all the easy stuff. Actually, I do want to start with an easy question, which is, can you explain what the CFPB is?
Sure. It's CFPB stands for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That was a federal government agency created by Congress in 2010 under the Obama administration. And the purpose of it is to look out for consumers in their consumer finance issues, which is anything having to do with mortgage loans, auto loans, student loans, credit card debt, payday loans, all the ways in which consumers borrow to finance their lives and then have to worry about how to pay it back.
And the Bureau has tangled for years with different mortgage lenders, even the National Association of Realtors.
We did, although I will actually say that it was a success story, because if you go back before the financial crisis of 2010, when the entire economy blew up, and it blew up in particular because of bad lending, a lot of it in the mortgage area, that's part of what led to the CFPB being passed by Congress. It's not a normal thing for Congress to create a new government agency, but they thought it was necessary in light of the problems that mortgage market had caused for our economy. And as a result of that, one of the tasks that the CFPB had on its plate, the biggest, most important first task, was to create new mortgage regulations to make the mortgage market safer. So we didn't have these exploding mortgages, these faked fraudulent mortgages that had blown up the economy. And we put those rules in place in 2012, and the mortgage market has been much safer since. Let me give you a data point on that. The CFPB later was challenged in front of the U.S. Supreme Court because of the structure was argued to be unconstitutional. The mortgage lending companies filed a brief supporting the CFPB's constitutionality because they said it would create so much ruckus for the mortgage market if the CFPB were to be struck down. They supported its continued existence because they thought we had made the mortgage market much safer for all the participants and for consumers. So that was a real point of favor for their view of what had happened from the CFPB.
So in the previous episode about corporate ownership of housing, we talked to a local home provider here in Cincinnati, and she had argued, and I found this pretty interesting, that some of the mortgage reform made it more expensive or sort of less desirable for banks to issue small home loans, say $100,000 or less. And that maybe the reason we aren't seeing small starter houses is because banks aren't going to make money off them, so they're encouraging construction companies not to build them. It's sort of like a side effect of Dodd-Frank. What is your take on that?
Yeah, I actually have a different take on that, and it's one I've been hearing for a number of years. I don't think that any of that was a result of the mortgage regulations. They're pretty neutral in terms of size of houses that are built. The problem for building smaller houses is that there have been new zoning regulations and new building requirements that make it just very difficult to build an affordable small home. I've talked to a lot of builders about this because we wanted to encourage them when I was at CFPB to get more supply into the market, which would lower prices, right? That hasn't happened. But I don't think it hasn't happened because of regulations on the financial side. I think it has to do with zoning restrictions. It has to do with building codes. It has to do with a lot of things that builders tell me just make it very difficult to build a house and sell it for anything less than $200,000, $250,000, even in lower priced markets like much of middle America. So that's what I think the problem is. So we have had a constricted supply of affordable housing for quite some time, and that is a problem in the housing market. But in terms of solving that, and by the way, one of the things I know you're going to get to is the effects of inflation and interest rates on this, which have really dried up supply as well and pushed housing prices higher. So there's several different pieces, different dominoes here that together have led to the housing market as we have it today.
Yeah, before I get to interest rates and inflation, I did want to quickly touch on this settlement deal that the National Association of Realtors just agreed to, because it is a big deal, especially for anyone who's bought or sold a house in the last couple of years. But first, I think we need to understand just how powerful the NAR is. And as someone who has tangled with them over the years, I don't want to call them a shadow group because that makes it feel like they're nefarious, and I'm not making that accusation at all, but they're kind of this group that flies under the radar, but has a lot to do with how homes are bought and sold.
Yeah, there's nothing nefarious about the National Association of Realtors. They're just a trade association like any other, and they look out for their membership and try to protect them and make the market work well for them. That's a very normal thing. That's what trade associations do. What is happening right now, as you're mentioning, is there has been a lawsuit. For many years, it's been thought that the realtors had colluded with one another to keep the actual seller's fee and buyer's fee higher in the United States than you find it in the rest of the world. Much of the rest of the world, you can buy and sell a house, and the total fees going to realtors would be 3% or less.
Total.
Some places as low as 1.5%. Here, though, typically they had stuck at 6%, 3% for the buyer, 3% for the seller. And there were lawsuits that were brought for years. This has been true for decades, Anna. It's nothing new. And finally, one of the lawsuits made enough progress that it was settled very recently, the last month or so. And it's going to be a bonanza for consumers because the rates they're going to have to pay to realtors to buy or sell a house are going to be going down. We don't know how much yet, but certainly they're going to go down a significant percentage. if 6% goes to 4% or even 3%, that's $2,000 or $3,000 per 100,000 of house sold. So if you buy and sell a house for $250,000, you know, that could be you know, $6,000 to $9,000 in savings, which is very significant for people. So that's a very good development for consumers, I think.
Yeah, it's the price of one thing that perhaps isn't going up. It could be going down. Yeah, 6% of the average home price here in Central Ohio amounts to $18,600. And, you know, that gets wrapped into the loan, but it also gets wrapped into the home price. So what the real estate agent will usually say is, we're going to raise the price of your house to cover that commission. So the theory is, right, like that home prices could drop maybe a little bit from this settlement.
Yeah, it's likely to make the buying and selling of houses loosen up a bit, because you know, people who buy a house are reluctant to then sell it a year or two later because they paid so much in commission the first time. Now they have to pay it again the second time, and that really cuts into their ability to make a profit or even break even. And what happens with people is they want to stay where they are, but things happen in their lives, right? They change jobs, or they lose a job, or they get a new job and they have to move, or there are family reasons why they have to move, or they get married and then they settle down somewhere else. All those things cause people to have to sell houses, and they can hang on as grimly as they can, but eventually that's going to happen. And so, for example, we saw house sales rising last month. That is, you know, a harbinger that maybe we've gotten to the point where people, people's lives are such that they are going to need to move more houses, sell more, others are going to buy more, and this market is going to return a little more toward normal. And some of this has to do with the changes in inflation that I know you want to get to here in a second.
Yeah, that's a great segue. Let's start with interest rates, though, because a lot of the reason I think some people are hanging onto their house as long as they can is if they have one of those 2%, 3%, even 4% interest rates.
Yeah.
They're looking at the housing market and going, I can't move up. I can barely make a lateral move. Like, I'm going to stay here for as long as I can.
That's been true, I think, for a lot of homeowners going back 4 or 5 years now, because after the financial crisis, all through the teens, the 20 teens, interest rates went down to virtually 0% at the Fed funds rate, which means that mortgage rates, people could get a mortgage and close on it for, you know, sometimes 2.5%, 3%, 3.5%. And having done that, they want to lock that in, and they don't want to give it up. And, you know, so they don't want to have to sell their home because they don't want to change the mortgage or anything. If they buy a new home, they know they're going to get a higher rate, because in 2022, the Federal Reserve began raising interest rates. They were worried about inflation. And they wanted to slow down what they saw as an overheated economy. I mean, unemployment has been low for years now and still remains below 4%. And inflation had crept up. The Federal Reserve started raising interest rates. They feared that they were behind the curve, so they raised them very fast. The Fed funds rate has gone all the way up from practically zero to about 5.5% now, which means that mortgage rates are even higher. So if you're someone who got one of those low rate mortgages, you don't want to give that up, because if you have to go and finance a new home at this point or a different home, you're going to have to pay, you know, 7% a month. And that has really discouraged people. Now, though, 2 years in to the Fed's rate rising campaign, they are now on the verge of starting to lower rates. And as they start to lower rates, the market has started to lower mortgage rates and will continue likely to lower mortgage rates. And that will encourage more people to buy or sell homes. And this will start to return back to normal. But it has been an abnormal situation for quite some time.
I think that's one of the things that some folks have trouble swallowing, is that these rates after the financial crisis were low, but they were also historically low.
Very true.
6%, 7%, 8% is pretty average when you look at how long we've been tracking interest rates. But in this world of new normal, where home prices stay so high and these interest rates, if they're just the new normal, I think it feels so much harder for a lot of folks, because I think the rising price in housing was being hidden at least a little bit by the super low interest rates.
That is very true. And until the housing market starts to loosen up and they build more homes, you don't get an increase in supply and prices will remain tighter than, probably we would like them to. But certainly the interest rate move that is on the horizon, by the way, the Fed has not actually lowered rates yet. They have said they were going to. They've given predictions that they will. Things are looking better in the economy. They're ready to start to make that move. But people had expected that might come as soon as March. Now it's more likely June, maybe even July. We will see. They get new economic data, of course, every month, and they try to build that into their predictive models. And we'll see where they land. But certainly we're on the verge of interest rates starting to come down. They are not going to be going up any further unless something really unexpected happens. But
they're not going to hit 2% again anytime soon.
Yeah, that should be good news for the mortgage market and for the home buyer market. Yes.
Yeah, because it kind of gums up the works when like the people who are supposed to be moving up just decide that they've stopped moving up. But you know, it's not just interest rates, I think, that are getting under the skin of people. It's the rising cost of their childcare, the rising cost of their groceries. Childcare is up, I think, almost a quarter over the last couple of years, which, I mean, a lot of times that's more. Your childcare is more than your mortgage, especially if you have multiple kids.
Yeah, part of that is people going back into the workforce because, jobs are available. And many jobs are paying a bit more than they did before. And as more people go back to the workforce, there's more demand for childcare. And of course, that will push the prices up there. And we do have a shortage of childcare providers. And the federal government has been trying to work with Congress to do some things to offset that. But, supply and demand ultimately will win out in the economy. And that's an issue. In terms of all the different things you said that can affect inflation, when you take them in the aggregate, some of them are higher, some of them are lower. Altogether, inflation has been coming down. It's been coming down from a peak of about 8 or 9% about the year before last, last year, to down in the range of 3%, getting down toward 2%, which is what the Federal Reserve would really like to see. I think 2.8 was the last reading. And we're going to get another reading on Friday. But in any event, this is happening. Some of us would like to have seen it happen faster, but all good things come to those who wait. And as interest rates come down, that will definitely help the housing market, and it should be on the upswing.
And if you're curious why having inflation at all is sometimes a good thing, we did a whole hour on inflation last week on All Sides. So you can find sort of your inflation 101 questionnaire that you can get all your questions answered, because 2% is pretty ideal. But I still say, and I said it earlier this hour, if the price of my eggs are going up less than that what they were going up 2 years ago, I don't know. I guess I'm happy that they're not like making those big jumps. But they're not exactly like going down, if that makes sense. So I'm like, oh, okay. So they're only up 50 cents this year instead of $2 this year.
Well, there are some prices that are going down, and prices bounce around all the time. Gas prices are a very visible price that a lot of people take their bearings from, and they go up and down. They went down quite a bit over this past year. They're up actually over the last few weeks. You can't help but, look at them as you go by, whether you're getting gas or not. You're just very conscious of that number because it's one that you deal with all the time. And some of the other prices you deal with less frequently, but they do come down. There are a lot of food prices that have come down and then a few have gone up. People tend to focus, Anna, as you have seen, I'm sure, they tend to focus on the ones that go up more than the ones that go down. So they get a little bit of a misleading impression that inflation is higher because they're kind of looking for it. And part of it is wringing it out of the economy is to get inflation expectations back down to a normal level, which they're a little high right now. People are kind of seeing that even where maybe it's not the full picture.
That was Richard Cordray, the former director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that'll do it for this hour of Untangled. Next week, we're looking at generational wealth and why white Americans are more likely to be homeowners.